And I'm going to be addressing first a couple of philosophers who are out there convinced of climate change. So this is obviously a position, maybe a skeptic, and that's just fine. But I'm addressing folks who have been talking about it from a non-skeptic point of view. And one of the things that immediately occurs when you talk to the few philosophers, you know, there's too few philosophers thinking about climate change, I think, in their profession. But one of the things you find in literature is that there's usually two things in common. One, that climate change is fundamentally a moral issue. So whatever else it is, if it's social, economic, environmental, it's, for those folks, it comes down to a moral issue. And secondly, it comes down to the kind of moral issue that overextends a lot of the ethical and moral, theoretical purchase that we have gained in Western civilization. In other words, the ethics that we all, the ethical tradition that we have cannot meet the moral demands that climate change requires. And so you have two things going on. One, climate change is a moral problem, and secondly, it produces an ethical crisis. So I want to first summarize a little bit of two thinkers who have been, I think, most clear about some of the elements of the crisis, which I think leaves us pretty open-ended, and then I want to insert my work, which is a theoretical perspective in environmental justice, as a way to try to address the crisis as they presented it. there's two philosophers, Dale Jamieson, who's at the New York University, wrote a nice piece in the early 90s, and he was first really pointing out that we don't actually have the measurements in our ethical tradition to handle the conditions of climate change. And so he was asking for a type of paradigm shift. A friend and student of his who went to Cornell and who's now a very big name in climate ethics, Stephen Gardner, is at the University of Washington. And Gardner built up Jamieson's point about this being a crisis in ethical theory with a very interesting metaphor, the perfect moral storm. And if you know the story of the Andrea Gale, which is the perfect storm, right, you may have seen that, right? Three storms collide. We would think that one storm was bad enough, and maybe the captain of the Andrea Gale could have navigated around. Two storms, maybe he would have mustered up the ability to pull through. But three, we know the tragic consequence. So what we have here is a tragic consequence of this perfect moral storm. So you've got a triad working here, and each of the triad has three characteristics. So the first storm that Gardner points out is, look, the climate change issue is a global storm, right? In terms of the spatial distance, people are being impacted at great distances, whereas to go back to Jamieson, in our tradition of ethics, we've often seen the people who are actually harming. And so we could actually get a grip spatially on who it is we're impacting, who it is we have obligations towards, what kind of responsibilities we have. But now we're out of sight from these folks. And we could argue that there are technologies and television and satellites that allow us to get a sight on the folks. But the great distances create one type of storm. Secondly, the kind of impacts that people are talking about in terms of climate change is that this is a cumulative effect over a long period of time. It's an intergenerational storm. And not only have we not had much in terms of our ethical tradition to deal with people who are out of sight or out of our spatial grasp, right, out of our community, but it's only been a couple of decades that anyone has even thought about intergenerational justice in the Western tradition, and we're pretty short-changed on that, because in this case, what we're doing now is an impact in very, very small bits to future generations. We're not quite sure how far, and it started around 1750, or the beginnings of modern industrial society and industrial revolution. So what was happening in little tiny bits 100 years ago is what's accumulating on to us now. So those folks didn't have any concept of the intergenerational impacts that the Industrial Revolution was going to have on us, and we certainly are ethically out of reach to get it further, according to Gardner. And there's also a theoretical storm, which is really what I've been talking about in terms of Jameson, which is that if you look at the dynamics of the way that our tradition has operated, it has always been, and although we've doctored it, everyone from Aristotle and the idea of moral responsibility and intentional action, unintentional action, really is about people with us now and people usually within our community. If you want to stretch it to the modern nation state, okay, people within the modern nation state. And so we know that we have global justice issues as part of a result of what we can't quite handle as a tradition. Now, each of these has three characteristics. Each of them have a broad dispersion of the causes and effects, whether it be spatially, temporal, or within the way that we've seen cause and effect in the tradition. There's a fragmentation of agency. We're not sure, for instance, who's really responsible for climate change. Would it be our parents, their parents, their parents, or us? And if we don't take responsibility, would it be our children? And if they don't take responsibility because we didn't take responsibility, their children. And you can see the cumulative effect is going to roll out. There's also, for each of these, an institutional inadequacy. We're working in institutions that are primarily nation states. So when you think about the global order, we're talking about nation states. Leadership of nation states has a very short lifespan. Right? We have a 4-year lifespan to our leadership. Maybe it goes to 8. Nation states are one small geographic area. Global problems are much larger geographic area. And they're national types of problems. Intergenerationally, we have a temporal leadership that lasts for maybe 8 years, maybe a person's lifetime, but the problem of climate change goes beyond every administration over and over. You try to count how many administrations climate change has actually been growing through, it would take you back to probably the Adams or Jeffersonian folk. And and in terms of the theory, thinking in terms of the nation state is obviously becoming pseudo-antiquated when you look at the global markets, transnational corporations running the global economy. So nation states are actually becoming more and more inadequate. Okay, so for Gardner, this is, it's not just a crisis because, as Jameson said, we lack some of the tools within our tradition, but it's a crisis with this triad coming together. So it's a far more desperate, perhaps tragic and unhappy situation for philosophers than we've had before. He doesn't offer too much in terms of a solution. I think he's going to build a whole industry on trying to get a solution out of a philosophical solution out of this, because it requires paradigm shifts in all sorts of ways. But he does point out that because of these things that may not be direct faults of our own in the traditional sense, it leads to a lot of moral corruption. And by moral corruption, he doesn't mean people just being bad, but moral corruption in the sense that we don't have the moral tools or the ethical tools to actually get a grip on the issue. And so we don't think it's our fault, then we continue going on the way that we behave, how that would work. The point on green virtue theory is Dale Jameson's point when he was looking at the inadequacy of the ethical tradition, or the ethical crisis, if you will. And he said, What we really need to do is create a paradigm shift. We need to come up with new green virtues like humility and mindfulness and preservation and these things. So this is a 1990 paper. He has a more recent paper which is interesting. It says something, it's the title of something like, when utilitarians need to become virtue theorists, right? So he's a utilitarian and he switches over to virtue theory. Okay, so there's your crisis. That's I think they've articulated it very well. It's a nice measure of what we're up against. Enter environmental justice, which is my angle. I've offered a definition that I've used quite a bit, and it's actually very important to have the future generation nearby. So this is just the sound of playing into my theory. This is where I'll conclude. So just don't forget this sound. Environmental justice is a more typically newer movement within environmental philosophy, and I guess the shorthand of it is, where there are social problems, we get environmental problems. Environmental problems are social problems. You can't separate these two. But what I've offered here is a type of philosophical definition, conceptual connections and causal relationships between environmental issues and social justice. In the United States, the environmental justice movement was sort of merged from the anti-toxics movement, and then there was concerns that the environmental burdens of modern industrial societies, such as toxic waste facilities and landfills, were falling into the neighborhoods and communities of the poorest and the disenfranchised minorities of the U.S. There was a lot of debate over whether or not it was race or class. People have sort of matured out of that and recognized in modern race theory that separating race and class is kind of a smokescreen and maybe even a false dichotomy. If you think about it, race in the United States pretty much started for economic reasons and then turned around to be cultural reasons, and the legacy of race, the legacy of ethnic discrimination, comes with it the prize of perhaps concentrated poverty and things of that sort. But we can find instances, even precursors of environmental justice movement in the United Farm Workers at Cesar Chavez, or even more recently the Vieques Puerto Rico strike against the U.S. Navy to finally get the U.S. Navy out of that area because of how much toxic it was. So I won't go too much into that, the environmental justice discourse, in terms of the movement, except to say that in the U.S. it's a very strong movement. And when you then put it into the global context, advocates of environmental justice suggest that it's the fastest, largest growing movement in the world. And anywhere social justice and environmental issues connect, where you have a grassroots organization responding to it, whether it be a mega dam project in India that's relocating people, whether it be the relocation of people from the Marshall Islands, whether it be the relocation of Inuits, whether it be even the high diabetes content in American Indian populations as a result of the change of the environment and social injustices that have been laid against their dietary habits, these become broadly construed environmental justice issues. So the trick quiz question at the end of the talk is, well, what's not an environmental justice issue, right? So do we overextend it? But this is a pretty standard definition. So you go back to Aristotle, he was wise enough to see that distributive justice is the primary issue that we think about when we think about justice. Justice is fairness, justice is getting what you deserve, justice is getting what you deserve determined according to merit. And Aristotle was, in the fifth book, as you know, Nicomachean Ethics, very clear about looking at distributive justice. And since Aristotle, I would say the dominant paradigm of justice has been distributive justice. It matches very well to economic justice. It matches very well to issues of fairness. You've seen it before. So environmental justice was particularly concerned with the ways in which underrepresented groups, whether it be lower socioeconomic communities or racial minorities or both, were receiving a disproportionate amount of the environmental burdens. And I can cite for you 30 years of studies that have not only go so far as proven this, but in fact the last, since 1987, the only three national studies that have been carried out on this phenomenon, the relationship of toxic waste to racial minorities and lower socioeconomic groups and communities, have concluded that race is actually the greatest indicator of where these things will be located in terms of block to block. So in terms of the community of the people. So look at a poor white community, look at a poor black community, you put them next to each other, it's going to end up on the poor black community, more likely, in fact, three times more likely. You look at a middle-class black community, and you look at a poor black, poor white community, and it's more likely to end up in the middle-class black community as well. So it's 30 years of study. So that's the distributive paradigm has been there, and we know there's nothing these folks are doing that deserve this kind of environmental burden. Most of the poor, if we want to keep it to the class element, don't consume as much as the rest of the people, and in terms of, say, the just real distributive justice in terms of commensurability, we might say the wealthy deserve more waste. They consume more, they produce more, they deserve more, all things being equal. I mean, it's commensurate, right? I mean, the poor have done nothing to deserve. They don't consume, they don't enjoy the burdens. So that's been a major discussion there. But because we're talking about things like race and ethnic groups, there's a side of the justice dimension that relates to, you might say, a kind of old form of identity politics, but more about cultural issues. And so even if you're a distributive justice theorist and you say, look, it all comes down to distributive justice, you have a dilemma on your hands because you have to work through the mechanism of just deserts. So how do I deserve this? And then your answer is, well, you merit it in some way. But it becomes circular. You have to figure out who determined merit in the first place. And well, the person with the merit determined the merit. Right? So that's one problem. Okay, because you can keep going ad infinitum. This is that. Okay, so if it's the people who deserve it, it's the people who merit it, how did that person ultimately merit it? And you can wax Nietzschean and genealogy if you like. Somebody at one point said, because it's me, and I merit it. And the people who look like me, and the people who behave like me, and my blood relatives, we want it the same way. We have the merits, right? And on and on. So the recognition theories of justice, which have only been, say, 50 years old, they're dominant from civil rights movement through women's movement through identity politics and into things much more sophisticated. Is also in there. It's who participates, who has the agency, and who has the voice. So you notice there's getting to be a split, right, about not just distribution, but who's making the environmental decisions. Because it's not enough to say, well, let's just then dump everything on the rich. How will that work? Who's making the decisions to dump it on the rich? Most likely, affluent people, right? They're the ones in power, will make the decision. So how will they make that decision? And how will that stop the flight away from those environmental burdens? Because people who have affluence have mobility. So will that actually will chase them with the environmental burdens? Is that what we'll do? So there's two dimensions. Now this is a bit of a controversy, but I want to push this recognition dimension a little bit further. I'm borrowing from the language of identity politics, but again, not in the crass sense where you have this kind of epistemological privilege automatically because somebody is from a particular background or something like that. Instead, really try to twist this in an environmental philosophical way and talk about the issue of environmental identity. So I define it as the amalgamation of cultural identities, the ways of life and self-perceptions that are connected to a given group's physical environment. So quite simply, we're all embodied, and hopefully nobody here is disembodied right now. I mean, you know, kind of felt that way in the traffic here, but right, okay, we're not disembodied, we're all embodied. But that's a, you know, that's an old phenomenological existential trick to say we're all embodied. Where are we embodied? Right? Embodied anywhere? Right? So, okay, you know, anti-Cartesian, here I am. I'm an embodied self. Okay, good. Where is that? Right? How much does the spatialization and the environment actually dictate what it means to be an embodied self? And what I've just shown you is actually determined by your embodied self also tells us what kind of environment you're likely to live in. Minorities are 3 times more likely to live in the polluted and toxic areas. And if you're a minority in this country, you're 4 times more likely to live with 2 of those sites in your neighborhood or more. Right, so it's not just distributed as one, but there's a saturation phenomenon, which is once a corporation can say something in one place, then you continue to pollute in that area. And so, as you can tell. But identity is a little too static. It has to exist over time. Okay? And this is where I put in this, since we're talking about an environmental identity as something that's a community-oriented, it is also something that needs to exist over time. It's a heritage. Okay? A community leaves a heritage forward. We don't leave heritage behind. We leave it forward. Most people think of heritage in terms of, you know, these sites, heritage sites, you know, stuff that was left behind. But it's actually not. It's actually connected to a legacy. This generation of people in this room create a society of value, and then we leave it forward. Right? And that's the heritage that we leave to our children, then they make a choice on that. They inherit that, and they make a choice. We want to keep it, or we don't want to keep it. So you think about the World Heritage Commission, and why do we have Auschwitz as a cultural heritage, world cultural heritage site? Why would that happen? Because wouldn't we want to leave it behind us? In fact, we want to put it forward so that future generations will not commit the same offense against humanity. Right? So here we are living in our identities that are environmentally situated, and we have also the agency to think about what we want to lead forward, and that's the environmental heritage. But many of us have a long-standing environmental heritage. There are people with farmers, who their grandparents and their grandparents and their grandparents. You know, my name comes from fig farmers, you know, through the countryside of Portuguese, right? Portugal. So we have, you know, these are heritages that we then take on, and that's largely part of our identity. Okay, so that's pushing the recognition side a little more to kind of pair it together. Now, to be quick about this part, just shifting gears about the problem of having distribution on one element and recognition on the other element is during the 90s in particular, there was a major debate in terms of justice paradigms. You had Rawls coming forth with a dominant distribution, and then you had various groups, race theorists, feminist philosophers, etc., coming forth and saying, well, it's not just about distribution, and again, because merit creates a myth, right? It creates its own circularity if it's just about distribution. So the problem that, this is drawn from Nancy Fraser, who's a political theorist, the problem is that if you're on the distribution side, then you look at things like the injustice in terms of the inequitable distribution of something. You look at something in terms of the remedy, in terms of redistributing or compensating. You look at the issue of what do you mean by the collective group who's receiving the justice, and we tended to look at it in terms of a class or a socioeconomic group, right? You just redistribute the goods to the people, and that's a class-oriented. And we looked at this note of difference, even going back as far as Marx, as a process of elimination. Right? You eliminate the bourgeois and the proletariat. You eliminate the class differences. You don't pride the class differences. So ultimately, distributive justice would make us equitable in a way that we actually eliminate the differences that we experience. Now, on the recognition theories of justice, you get a pulling force that goes in diametrically opposed. In terms of the injustice, it's not about how things have been distributed, but how you've been represented. Right? Do you have the vote, women? Do you have the vote, African-American, etc.? Right? Where are you in the representation? And in terms of the remedies, you bring in inclusion. Affirmative action was one interesting way of doing it, but you bring in more inclusion. You bring in people into education, you get them represented, you get their voice out there. Okay? In terms of the collectivity that we typically associate, it's a cultural collectivity. When we talk about race as a cultural collectivity, we don't typically talk about it as a class. That's why people do this race-class dichotomy. And if you follow that sort of multicultural rhetoric, what do people do with their differences? They celebrate them, or they deconstruct them and get them better, right? But they rarely talk about eliminating difference in the way that we would find with the distributed paradigm. So here I'm saying, okay, now environmental justice has these two pillars, and if you're talking about justice theory, there's this thing called the recognition redistribution problem, right? Where these things are pulling against each other. Well, this is really a heuristic device to show how distributive theories couldn't quite agree with recognition theories, but there's as I point out earlier on, I sort of gave away the hint, there's a real problem in the collectivity issue, and that is there are no collectivities that are strictly class or strictly cultural. These are, as we would call it in chemistry, bivalent. Right? So how do we understand the history of African Americans in the United States? You understand them simultaneously, economically, and culturally. The same with Latinos. So what happened wrong was that the distributed paradigm was creating a class economist type of collectivity, and the recognitions were looking at strictly cultural. But the argument here is that's why you're pulling against, but the collectivity that you're defining is actually a false collectivity. There is no such person who's not cultural and class. And you can take that back to Marx, if you like. Right? It was, he thought he was eliminating culture from the picture, but what he actually did, I would argue, is he dumped culture into class consciousness. Right? There's a class consciousness. Class consciousness is a cultural perspective. If you've ever met somebody with a class consciousness one way or the other, you know it's a cultural perspective. Right? No one is that silly to just think that their wealth or the lack thereof is what's defining their identity. They need a community to help them do this, okay? And they need a history, old money, young money. So if the collectivity never really goes one way or the other in the polls, then what we really are operating with is a bivalent collectivity, and what we need is a bivalent solution to this particular problem. And I've just given some of the levels of the bivalent solution that Fraser gives. I won't get into this detail because I want to get back into the climate change issue. But notice what I'm trying to do here is now save the environmental justice definition that I've offered, where there's a distributive issue in terms of where the burdens fall, and there's an underrepresentation issue or a recognition issue. And now I'm going to suggest that seems to me a bivalent solution to the problems of these paradigm conflicts is the right one. And so if I'm going to offer a theory of environmental justice, it's going to be a bivalent one as well. That's just a picture, and that's some more picture. Okay. Now, there is something that bridges these two, because distributive justice tends to operate on one set of premises, even if we accept the bivalent collectivity, and the same with recognition. And that's, they both share this bridge of participatory parity. In distributive justice, it's often in terms of the language of voting rights. People get to participate in the system, and there's a representative democracy, and that's part of the distributive. In the recognition, it tends to be a much more deliberative democracy process, where it's a grassroots representation, not a voter representation. In other words, we're not just looking at people who vote and voting on their feet, but there's a real, are the people who are most affected leading the decision making? And that would be more than voting. That would be something like a robust sense of participation. So we have these two paradigms of justice that are being bridged by participatory parity, and that completes this bivalent picture. Okay, so this just now gets me the bivalent environmental justice, which is that you're going to get recognition justice demands that we fully account for the situational aspects of a group, mobilization for environmental justice by understanding individual and the community environmental identities, and that the environmental heritages are at stake. So we're bringing back the environmental identity, but also distribution of environmental burdens, which requires practical and political remedies, remains closely hinged to the ways in which groups' environmental identities and heritage are respected within a society. So trying to bring back this identity and heritage picture. Where are we going in climate change? Well, you can map this up to climate change a little bit, okay? There's your distribution, and you've got your burdens that are being distributed. We know that that these climate impacts are being distributed across the world. There's a historical responsibility that's involved here in terms of the distribution. We may have actually enjoyed the modern industrial revolution much, much longer than, say, developing nations have, and so we actually have a greater historical responsibility of distributing the burdens than do our southern nation colleagues. There are thresholds that get talked about in climate change. You've heard of mitigation and thresholds. That's the Kyoto Protocol. You have to have a threshold. It has to go back to 1990 levels, either 8% of 1990 levels. There's thresholds. That's a distributive point. There's intergenerational justice that we've talked about. And there's a number of compensatory obligations that have been wielded out there. That is, what do we do with island or atolls like the Marshall Islands that are being impacted by climate change and have had the further burdens of 64 atomic testings. We compensate them, actually, as it turns out, and we compensate them, and they constantly ask for it, even more so, because it goes that much further. But on the recognition side, you would say, well, look, seems like we're making all the calls. The Western, the Northern, the leaders of the UN, the regimes of the nation states, if you will. So one would call not for just working out the burdens and compensation, but one would say, it might be the case that we need those who are the most burdened right now by climate change to actually participate in a robust way to say how we should move forward. What about the heritage? What about the Marshall Islanders who must relocate once again? Where is their environmental heritage left? Is it left behind? Or let's take the island of Tuvalu. You may have heard of Tuvalu is sinking, right? It's near Fiji. I haven't been either, but I know it's near Fiji, and I know Fiji is near Tuvalu. But right. And so it's been sinking. So what's happening is the New Zealand government is nationalizing the Tuvaluans at a rate and bringing them to New Zealand. And I have count after count after count where people say, okay, now I'm Kiwi, except I'm obviously an Islander, and people come up to me and then they say, hey, what island are you from? And you have no environmental identity to go back to. And in fact, you have a new environmental identity, which is called a climate refugee, or an environmental refugee. You may have heard them from New Orleans. They're called environmental refugees, right? You may have heard them from Darfur, right? We call them political refugees, but they're political refugees as a result of a war that was created by climate change in their area and forced a migration pattern and then forced the political issue. So there's an environmental refugee status there. But right now we have a new identity emerging, a new heritage emerging. People are called climate refugees. The people who are Tuvalu Kiwis are called climate refugees. We might call them Kiwis. They don't see their heritage in just that fashion. Also on that side of the spectrum, we have the question of cultural sustainability. And most of all, there's the emerging form of reconciliation and restorative justice. Restorative justice has been used quite a bit in Australia and in New Zealand in criminal cases where victims and perpetrators come into a kind of mediation, and it has a dramatic impact on the perpetrator to have met the victim in such a way, maybe not face to face, but by mediation. And this also happens quite a bit in the truth and reconciliation between the First Nations people in Canada and the Canadian government. Now, it is a fact that a lot of people think this is just rhetoric and this is just lip service, but from a philosophical point of view, this is carving a new dimension of justice. Now, I'm not saying it's as effective as distributive justice or even effective as recognition justice, but have you ever seen what happens when a people ask the leaders of a nation to apologize for past atrocities? They don't do it. Now, a lot of people think, oh, that's because you're going to then have to compensate them. Well, there's something deeper to it. It's not recognizing that what you did was actually an atrocity, right? That's part of what people want from the leadership is their identity. And because we're talking bivalent, it's not surprising that when I get an apology, then I actually then go and say, well, since you've apologized, you officially stated that you owe me some compensation. But my point is, it doesn't just collapse into distribution, that this is actually means something to those groups. And in Australia, they have the Sorry Day for Aboriginal peoples. The Uluru Pad Judah, which was Ayers Rock, as you probably have heard it, is often called the Sorry Rock because it's a reconciliation process. So when we get to this point, we see that most of what we're talking about in terms of climate change is about restitution, repairing the earth, or mitigating or creating thresholds to the earth so that we can stop the increase in climate change. But also, I'm arguing that there's an issue of reconciliation to be met. Okay, so now let's think about the ethical crisis, and I'll just jump ahead to something in terms of a conclusion. Okay, so we've got our environmental justice theory. We know that Gardner told us we've got a severe ethical crisis on our hands, that we really don't have things available. He likes to talk about things in terms of pure intergenerational justice. And the reason he thinks pure intergenerational justice is important, his articulation is, when we think about future generations, we should think about them as discrete entities, discrete agents, so that we can use something from the old theories to say, okay, here's one agent doing a wrong to another agent in the future, they're discrete entities, and then we can connect them. I think that's wrong. I think it's actually philosophically fun to create discrete entities, but I think in this room alone, we may actually have three generations of people coexisting. So I think talking about us in terms of discrete generations is actually wrong. It's a philosophical trick, if you will, right? To make some use of a philosophical tradition, and that's great. But, and I say three generations because you heard my sound effects outside. Okay, we know that person is part of our conversation right here. It's an intergenerational justice conversation. We know that this person will be dealing with our problems much longer than we will, and they will be worse, because there will be more of it. Okay? Whether or not we're skeptics of climate change, we can see a trajectory, whether or not it's caused by the Earth's tilt or whatever else it is, you know, great atmospheric changes, you know, solar storms. We're not doing anything to mitigate dramatically our impacts. So there's a sort of Pascal's wager here. What if it is the case, the climate changing? Right? Well, even if it's not, are you doing anything good? Yeah. You're not being a consumptive glutton of the world's resources, right? I mean, there is a little bit of a gamble here, but I have a feeling you'd come out on the moral bright side if we weren't 1/4 of the world's population consuming, you know, 4/5 of the world's resources. That just, I don't know. Usually I can't do math after 6 o'clock, but that seems to be an easy one. Okay, so what I don't... So what I disagree about with Gardner, and I think that the crisis is there, is I disagree with this idea of coming up with, you know, these discrete generations and bringing up. I think that we should be thinking in terms of heritage, and we should be thinking about things in simultaneous generations that already exist. Not to appeal to emotion, but it's not hard for me to say, okay, I'm 44, and I know what it's like to be me at 44. And I look at my son, who's 6, I kind of know that he's going to be about my height and about my girth when he's 44. And we'll have some life experiences that a 44-year-old has, right? I'm not claiming that I'm like every 44-year-old, but I kind of know what he's going to be like when he's 44. I know what it is like to be a 44-year-old, and I kind of know, right, I can envision him there. So I can actually project my son forward into my place. I can make that kind of moral imagination of what it will be like to be him when he's 44. Right? And it doesn't take me too much to figure out it's going to be a trickier place environmentally. Okay? So not only do we have multiple generations existing, but we can actually reconcile with these multiple generations by various feats of moral imagination and by denying these ideas of discrete generations. So I offer really, I don't know, 5 domains for now where we might be able to try to address this ethical crisis in a different way. And it's not to argue, yes, our tradition has what it takes to solve the problem, because I think both Jameson and Gardner are wise on this. But one is we need to look at the ways in which we have bivalent justice and restorative justice as models. And we have them in many, many places where environmental disasters have occurred and reconciliation is ongoing. I've mentioned a few of those. So we see that if we can see those models and how they play out in terms of restorative justice, then one of the things that we'll know is that distributive justice is being waged to some extent, and we're recognizing cultures and environmental identities and heritages as they exist. And maybe there's a new way of looking at the environmental heritage of climate refugees. Or maybe there's a new way for us to reconcile with those who have a heritage of climate refugee. What's our environmental heritage? How would we change or transform our environmental heritage? Well, if you start poking around and blaming one person or the other, then you don't get too far. But if you notice, we all share one very, very rude environmental heritage, and that is our consumptive habits. Right? So we could collectively actually not blame one or the other, we could actually collectively agree that we don't want to pass that heritage on. Maybe that's not the legacy we want to bring forward. We wouldn't have to blame anybody. We'd actually do it. And we'd actually see that that's a heritage we can transform. Okay? So that's the general models. But then there's actually political models to, and I'll sum these up, you know, fairly quickly, political models to consider. where are the climate refugees or the people who are being impacted the most by climate, where are they in the decision-making policies? Are they an entity, whether it be an NGO or whether it be a UN entity that's actually recognizing them? Currently, climate refugees are not recognized by the UN, and environmental refugees are barely recognized. You can imagine what would happen. Political refugees already are undercompensated for their impacts and their woes. You know, nations have to give charitable contributions to refugee camps. Now we're going to expand it to environmental refugees. So you're going to draw from which fund? The political refugee fund? I mean, they're already in bad shape, so we'd have to give more. So there's already a misrecognition, and politically I think we need to bring them into not only recognition, but into policy. into panels, international panels with greater inclusion. If you actually had people who were impacted by climate the worst making some impact on climate decisions, my wager is that you get a broader epistemological benefit. And that's just my, you know, crazy philosophical way of thinking. The more knowledge you have on something, especially experiential knowledge, the better the epistemological range to draw solutions. And I share that with a couple of other crazy philosophers. You may be among one of them by the end of the evening. There's also ethical benefits, right? Because you're actually bringing in a form of justice with their inclusion. The social change that I've offered to address some of this crisis already is that we stop thinking of ourselves in terms of discrete generations, and look at ourselves as overlapping generations. So we've met our future. Our future is before us. And I know this is not a surprise to anyone, but it becomes a philosophical surprise in some way to the people who are thinking through climate ethics. And I think we also need to reconcile with the present populations. Those present people being impacted, we are now in a powerful position. We're the inheritors or the dominant legatees of climate change, if you will. We need to first be able to reconcile with the people who actually live here if we can continue and make it with the overlapping generations. Existentially, why not, right? Usually those who are the most well-off, again, kind of a intuition about justice, have more of the means to make the transformation than those who have those transformations forced upon them. Or at least it's a little bit more pleasant, let's say. So we actually have not only an obligation existentially, but an opportunity existentially to change the environmental heritage that we're leaving forward. Again, I pointed out as consumption, but it's not just consumption, you know, as a blanket thing. It's the green virtues, perhaps, that Jameson was talking about. It's also the social justice virtues. Right? I'm not talking just environmental aspects, I'm talking environmental justice. So if you do something in terms of global social justice and transform your behavior, you're going to have an environmental payoff. There's no longer an opportunity, my thesis, that we can separate those two. Oftentimes when we do our existential work, we don't really think about the legacy that we are as individuals. We think about it in terms of maybe our immediate family, but now every hot shower is a legacy, right? It's a legacy that leads forward. It's a lot of little people doing very small things, having very big impacts. And, you know, it's tragic to think of it that way, maybe even an exaggeration, that we can't reach beyond our moral horizon, the landscape of our moral horizon or something. But if you actually flipped it around into good stuff, if you said, we could all get together and do something really great, wouldn't that be a really nice feeling? But when you go, we've all gotten together, unbeknownst to ourselves, and done something really horrible. The people who don't exist yet and are going to be really, really far away from us, even if they did exist. Sounds so much better when you say, why can't we all just get along, right, the other way. But notice it's still it's an idea that I leave a legacy much broader than my own little individual family and the individuals I come in contact with. And we are now global entities. We're global identities, and we are transgenerational identities. So we have to see ourselves not only as embodied, but also temporal selves. The environmental is the bottom line, of course, just in terms of this talk, that we have a relational history with our environment, that we are not merely individuals making discrete decisions, but we are placed, we are in space. Space is political in and of itself. We operate in communities, and the communities aren't human by any means. I don't know if anybody ate what I ate tonight, but I rely on a lot of non-humans to make it through this talk. Yeah. Terms of spicy garlic shrimp or whatever it was. I mean, now, regardless of how I value them, if you're going to call yourself an embodied self in an environment, don't forget what's keeping you an embodied self in an environment. Right? No human yet has succeeded by living without relying on the non-human population. And I actually think this is a political population. Why? Because even if you're just a distributive justice theorist and you don't go for the recognition stuff, you have to explain to me how it is non-humans, which provide so many things for us, get all the burdens. Seems again, a discommensurate or incommensurate distributive justice. They haven't done anything to deserve it. Unless, of course, you think that not being human is enough to deserve that kind of treatment. Then we'll have to go back a bit. So, there's the bottom line, hopefully a lot of points for question. Thank you. Yes?
There's a very interesting program on PBS recently that kind of said, I actually used us to promulgate the years. So, there's an argument against your...
Yeah, and that's a great comment. And
burden cultivating.
They have used us, and I think they've used us. I think they probably should use us a little bit more. But the idea of the relational history is really a relational ethic. That we're in a relational ethic with non-humans. They are using us for all sorts of reasons. They benefit from us in all sorts of ways. I mean, we're certainly, we think the shark endangerment because of cutting off the shark fins in Japan is bad because it ruins the apex predator within that place. Well, we're an apex predator too, so we have to value ourselves within the environment as well. We just don't respect that part of ourselves as an apex predator. We really don't respect our role in the environment as an apex predator. Kind of cutting off our fins simultaneously and eating them. But there are a number of biologists and there's a number of folks who've been working in ecology and evolutionary theory who recognize that it's not just the environment playing all the facts on our adaptation and evolution over time or the organisms, but the organism is manipulating the environment such that that's leading as well to the type of evolution that occurs. So there is a symbiosis that goes unrecognized.
And the other thing was, the thing about the climate change, and especially the refugee levels, you better trust from climate change. That is a really important issue in certain culture. And that is a thing that we do all the responsibility to areas in the Atlantic just your list of Armenian people that they have waved their tongue in iron. So that's a frightening thing, and of course, he makes it down a lot.
Are you working up to a question?
Yeah, we could have possibly stopped that volcano. We could have stopped the environmental issue. So all we can do is follow.
Could you state your question, please?
It's to plant planters and plant foods. So that I wanted to see how you look at it as either local or local institution.
One point that you make is important, which is that climate refugees aren't isolated to just the South Pacific. I mean, that's why I mentioned New Orleans, not far away from us. The other is that the numbers, and these numbers get thrown around in all sorts of ways, so again, it's worthy to be skeptical of. But if you clock it as an environmental refugee, and I know these overlap with some of the political refugees, but if you clock the tally of environmental refugees, it comes up to about 50 million today. Now, the estimation, given the trajectory that different models, and models are almost all understated or inaccurate, however you want to look at it, given the models, the Red Cross, the International Red Cross, is seeing about 170 environmental refugees in the next 50 years. Other conservative estimates actually are 250 million refugees in the next 50 years. So the conservative element, when I say conservative, it's more than the Red Cross, there are even greater numbers by the models. And so you have to figure out, my response is, you know, if we've got 50 million now, where are those 250 million coming from? And where are they going? And remember, we were talking initially with environmental justice being an issue of the distribution of environmental burdens like toxic waste. But notice, it was toxic waste on to people who we already regard as sacrifice zones. Okay? Now, what are you going to think of a refugee coming into your area? You're going to feel like somebody's putting waste on you. We're going to be thinking of other human beings as a burden on to us in just that way. So these things are going to start to mirror one another over time. And so I think, again, this is really the urging is if you clock the numbers, it gives us more reason to think about the ethical crisis, but it also makes us think, I think, more that we're in connection with these future populations. It may even be our populations that are, I mean, if Texas is safe from all this, where do you think all the South Pacific Islanders are going to end up? You know, if we're on the only dry island, I mean, you know, they're canoeing, they're coming. Yes, sir.
You mentioned the courts as being caused by climate change, and from my perspective, it seems to me that that's more of a religious thing where the government particularly didn't like some people that didn't want to be Muslims,
yeah,
and decided that they had the right to kill them.
Yeah.
How did climate change cause this?
We have, well, the climate change relationship is that you had, let's say, always a possibility for ethnic strife. But when you have food resources available, because farming is working, because you don't have a lake drying up from desertification, then you can usually keep one ethnic group on one side of the lake, the other here. You can usually keep one group there and one group here. When that lake dries up from desertification, you no longer have the physical boundaries that often keep people. It's like being on the other side of the tracks. Once you get integrated, there might be an issue, right? You have to confront your prejudices in a different way. And that's That's what I'm referring to. There are these geographical boundaries that exist in all sorts of places that actually make for a peaceful situation, even in a volatile scenario. We don't just have to build walls to do it. We have natural barriers. But what happened in Sudan is that you had desertification, you had drought, and you had a food security problem. And then the food security problem ends up amassing into other things. Maybe pre-existing conditions, maybe some psychopathic leader who wants to do ethnic cleansing. But again, if you have the natural boundaries there, it's harder to do it. Now, I'm not saying that, if you've seen the landscape of Rwanda, for instance, you can't see past the other hillside. So there were boundaries there. So I'm not going to make the claim that in all instances there is a climate connection. But in this instance, you have the desertification is an environmental condition that brought clashing groups, or at least one dominant group, much, much closer to the other group that hadn't existed. Because they started, what you got is people migrating and people enclosing in. And I think you get something like the worst case scenario of what could be happening with climate refugees in the future. But by no means is climate the cause of ethnic cleansing. No.
Oddly enough, my husband and I are Darfur activists, and we've actually been in Darfur, and I'll be very happy to talk to you about it after, because I don't want to tell you that it's time to do that. But this past year, the crop failure rate in Darfur itself has been 80%. So that's a huge problem. And I couldn't help but think of an analogy that I use about showers. The first minute that your shower runs in the morning, you've used more water than the average Darfurian gets all day. And that takes care of food, clothing, everything. But, it's a mess over there right now because Omar Bashir kicked out a lot of the NGOs. The group we were with was one of those that got kicked out. So, if anybody has any questions about what's going on over there, I'll be happy to.
And the first thing that made me think of refugees and environmental justice was just the conditions of refugee camps, particularly in Darfur. It made me realize that the living conditions are so extreme as an environmental injustice, just the living conditions.
One man is subhuman, and when they find a rat, that's dinner.
Then as I explored further, I realized, well, there's not just the condition of the camp, there's a refugee condition that fits into it. But if anybody really wants to treat your children to an international career, it's in food security. And food security is the future problem. I mean, I'm naming one of them in terms of climate change, but it's going to be food security that's going to be, if your kids are going to college, tell them to go into international relations or whatever it is, and hit with food security, because that's where the brains have to be.
We have a question over here.
Sorry.
The Supreme Court just recently said corporations should fully be acknowledged as people. So we're talking about voices, and yet a corporation, this is more politically, but a corporation, has a lot more voice than I do, or even maybe a group of people. But this really relates to a long article that I just read about how our environmentalist groups, a lot of them, are really taking a lot of money from the different corporations that have an interest in some of these issues. And interestingly enough, so then they were saying that some of them, they don't lobby as hard on things that might relate to that particular corporation. Interestingly enough, this very nation, which is nation, sort of for the liberal and the political spectrum, that very magazine, one of the big ads was
Strange bedfellows in politics. Here's what attracted me to the idea of the environmental justice movement. And this gets into other characteristics that I haven't really described. There's another two elements to environmental justice. One we've been mostly talking about is the environmental discrimination element. But there is also an element which I call discriminatory environmentalism. And that is that environmental justice has come up from the grassroots of disenfranchised, mostly neighborhoods like the Love Canal organization that we saw with Lois Gibbs in 1978. These are not people who ever really regarded themselves as environmentalists. They are not enfranchised. They are Cesar Chavez and United Farm Workers. They are people working through the black churches in the South. They are anti-toxics movement people who are, the environmental justice movements around the world are 70 to 80% leadership is women. Predominantly women of working class and then predominantly women of color, but that would make sense even if you especially look at the globe. These are not people who stand up and call themselves feminists. They are people who broke off from feminists. They're not people who call themselves environmentalists. So what attracted me just as a minor biographical note was I was reading a Denver paper in 1990, and it was a battle between the Sierra Club Legal Defense Fund and the Ute Indian Tribes. And as the environmentalist that I was on one hand and the civil rights activist that I was on the other hand, I thought, well, this is really weird. I thought the Indians and the environmentalists got along. And then I realized what was behind it. And then I did legal classes to find out to follow the paper trail. So the environmental justice movement prides itself on being, first it was considered a people of color movement. In 1992 had the first national people of color environmental congress in which, really, if you're white, you weren't allowed in this meeting. It was 3 days of, and it was saying, look, let's just consider this for a second, and on racial lines, but also on the corporate lines, if you're saying, okay, we already see how the corporate, bedfellows work, but let's just think about this. When we talk about mainstream environmentalists, put the vision in your head and show me what color that person is. Now, if you track this philosophically and you say, okay, so that means that predominantly white movement that goes all the way up the federal chain and has corporate interests in its back pocket to get things done and to negotiate and make forests and everything else is not only defining what the environment is, it's defining what the environmental problem is, and ultimately it's doing what it's been doing for a long time, defining what nature is. Who's natural, who's closer to nature, and who's not closer to nature. If you're an environmentalist, you're closer to nature. 100 years ago, if you weren't closer to nature, you were a slave. Okay, so the thing is, the same people are calling the shots. So the environmental justice movement is actually a much more reactionary movement to this, and typically operate from grassroots and then spin off. But there's a mainstream element to it too. Sierra Club Legal Defense Fund, after some of that debacle, has changed its name. It's now called Earth Justice. Right? So yeah, it's a very good point, though. Very good point.
Let's say you eventually trick over the possibility of someone believing that environment, that climate change was used to recycle things beyond the control of man. Okay, now, if you take that position and say apply that to hate everything, okay, now, are you saying, well, my question is, how much of your view applies to that limited condition? And what I'm saying by that is, with the Haiti earthquake, you can take the position, well, it's due to the fact that for whatever reason, when they didn't build buildings, it's gone to the children. But if you can take a moral position and say, well, we're going to help them anyway, in our Christian position. But I'm saying that that altruistic position, it is not moral in its course. It's stronger than it is moral. And I'm going to be
No, that's a good point. So, I may not be giving you an answer that is satisfactory, but I'll spin it on the justice line. First, it would seem to me that there's natural disaster that has no. Nature doesn't make mistakes. Nature doesn't destroy. Right? If you look the deep ecological future, the deep ecological past, we've been through ice ages, we don't call that destructive. We've seen know, the dinosaurs come and go, we don't call that destruction. Right? Nature doesn't make disasters. Humans make disasters. Human responses to naturally occurring events is what's the disaster. Okay? So, was Hurricane Katrina a natural disaster? No, it's a political disaster. Okay? It was a social disaster. Natural disaster, that's a human-made term about just to define semantically whether or not it's a technological disaster, something blew up in your face, and you weren't expecting it, or something else blew up in your face, and you weren't expecting it. But nature doesn't do mistakes like that. In other words, it's just an act of the way that things happen. So it's about our response. So so if we follow from that, you have different types of housing. You have the poorest nation in the Western Hemisphere versus not the poorest nation in the Western Hemisphere, you see a different living condition. So the disasters weigh out, the human disaster weighs out worse from the natural elements. Now we say, so if we buy that, then the question is, how do you rebuild it? If you rebuild it as the poorest nation in the Western Hemisphere, I bet you'll get another natural disaster. It was a natural disaster. The living conditions were a natural disaster. The magnitude of malaria, the magnitude of disease that comes from bugs and mosquitoes and everything else was already that kind of natural disaster. We just see these spectacular moments as the natural disaster. But if you talk to Paul Farmer, who was working with all of these disease victims in his work there in Peru, if you talk to people in World War II who chose to spray DDT on our side of the troops and stop it right at the line where the Japanese troops were, we were using biological warfare. We were spraying our troops with DDT so we would get malaria and they would, right? So that's it depends on where you're at. Malaria is a natural disaster, right? No, it's just an illness that's getting it. So how should we rebuild people? So if we're coerced, if you're coerced into altruism, it's never going to be good. But I don't think I would coerce somebody into altruism as much as say, so now you have a chance to rebuild a nation. Why would you rebuild a nation as the poorest nation in the Western Hemisphere? That's an intentional move. Right? It's already destroyed. You're rebuilding. You have to actually decide, well, since it's the poorest nation, we'll just give them this much when we want, right? But that's like saying, well, why would we rebuild the richest nation, the most gluttonous nation, to be the same? That seems to be oddly, you know, the real force of altruism. As I say, the most gluttonous nation, it gets flattened, if that were the case, right? Thought experiment now. Would we rebuild it as the most gluttonous nation? Here's our opportunity. That would be forced altruism, that case. Somebody's already at least well off, and you have an opportunity to bring them to sustainable living, then I think it's something else than forced altruism. I think it's humanity. Right? I mean, I think there's various theories of justice, from capabilities theory to roles theory of justice to human rights theories of justice, which create a line that says humans don't really enjoy humanity any longer once they live below that line. And I think that there's a number of schools of thought that would work that even though they're competing here. So nations were living below that line. Now we have an opportunity to rebuild. How do we rebuild? So I'm not sure if that gets around the forced altruism, but I don't feel forced altruism. I feel
okay. No, I'm sorry. The last question is this gentleman right here.
As a huge fan of capitalism,
yeah,
the life that we do live, the hotshots that we get today, the way that we control nature, because nature's been changing as you have to recognize forever. Maybe, you know, if there's a flood, you build dams and we collect water. If there's droughts, we begin to collect water. If there's hot Texas, we figure out the life that we live, the length that we live, seems like that is the solution for warn people, don't build here. Take Haitians, build like they do in San Francisco and all that. Why are you not a more advocate of what capitalism, a life that is broken?
The life that's brought me, I'm really grateful. Okay? And the life that's brought you, I'm really grateful. But things become, I guess, an ethical issue when it's impossible for everybody else to adopt. So if we're 1/4 of the world population using 4/5 of the world's resources, how do we get it? Just show me the map. Show me how you're going to do it. You need 5 Earths, as far as I understand, for everybody else to get that. So now we're going to make a decision. Okay? We're going to say, we'll live at the level that we do, because this is what capitalism taught us, and the rest of you will not. So this is the philosophical question of what the good life is. And I guess I don't recall that the good life was ever designed for specific people without becoming discrimination. Right? We never said just those people, we said virtuous people. Or we said, from the philosophical tradition, we wouldn't collapse into monarchy for the decision of what is the virtuous life. So now we've got the virtues of capitalism, and we share it in precisely the amounts that we wish to share it, and by no means do we wish to share it. So the problem I have is not capitalism. Right? And the problem is that I can't give air conditioners to everybody, or refrigerators. And that's the problem I have. That's the problem of resources.
We have to produce it, right?
Yeah.
Production, and we're consuming it because we're producing it.
Yeah.
Because I take a hot shower, that means somebody in Sudan doesn't get that. I didn't take that hot shower from them.
No, not at all. That's precisely it. This is an ethical crisis for exactly that reason, because the ethical problems that exist don't go the way they used to. It's no longer a question of, I didn't take that from you, right? The impacts are temporally dispersed, and the impacts are spatially dispersed. So you and I aren't taking or giving anything to anybody. 350 million people, just doing what we're doing right now, are doing it together. Right, regardless of my implements, but over a long period of time. So even when you say, I'm not taking it from somebody in Darfur, you may not be taking it from somebody in Darfur, you might be taking it from somebody generations away. And notice that we wouldn't be in this situation if it wasn't already taken away from us for the last 100 years. Right? If our activities, we just started it right now, it would take hundreds of years to deal with climate change. Right? This started with the modern industrial revolution, 1750, and it's only increased. We're far more environmentally sound than we were in, you know, Pittsburgh in the 1870s, right? So we're inheriting what that left. We're inheriting their CO2 emissions and adding on to it. But I think, so one question is it a technological solution that we need to offer that could be part of the mitigation? But if you think that technology has some direct impact on how we got to this place, then the same technological paradigm, technological solution, doesn't guarantee you're going to be able to erase this. That's why I started off with climate change, the moral problem. It's not a technological problem. It's a moral problem about who we are responsible to and who is responsible over and back to us. If we're a technological solution, then, how long should we wait until the technological solution comes? I hear a lot of technological solutions. I hear wind power, I hear hydropower, I hear all sorts of things. In almost all cases, I hear people saying, there's just not enough money and research being put into it. That's an interesting point. So let's have a lot more research and a lot more money put into modern industrial, technological, technocratic
societies while other people starve. That would make sense for justice. Right? We're not going to give it. That's why these people have debts to us. Because we never gave it to them in the first place. So the capitalism is the right thing. That's not the problem. It's the justice. Unless you think the two are, I'm not pushing that but some people might think that capitalism is an investment in justice. I'm not going to make that statement. That you must have an exploitation and alienation of the labor in order to make it work. I'm not saying that, right? But, so let's just call it justice over here and we'll do it in a capitalistic way. And I think that's what people like Martin Nussbaum and Martin Zen are trying to do, and they say, look, it wouldn't be an effective capitalism if you let people live below a particular line. So if you're going to keep capitalism in there and build human capacity, it's got to be human capacity at a level in which they can enjoy everything from knowledge to education to creativity and things of that sort. And most people starving don't have that luxury. But a good point. I wouldn't live without my air conditioner. I mean, the important thing is that anybody who talks about this stuff can't possibly get on a moral platform about it. Because we're all, that's why I say, our environmental identity and our environmental heritage is one and the same. I mean, I can't live without it, you can't live without it. But they didn't wake up when you were 9 months out of the womb and say, you know where I'm going to live, you know what I'm going to do. It's a moral luck problem, you might even say. We happen to be the ones who can't live without it. But a good point. Thanks.
All right. Thank you very much. No.